Job chapter 27 marks actually the continuation of a speech from Job that began in chapter 26. It's one of the longer speeches of Job in the book. Francis Chan, who is a guy I think very highly of, wrote in his book, Crazy Love, gave a little illustration that I thought was pretty pertinent to the whole question of hypocrisy and of integrity. Francis Chan wrote, "Recently I saw a bag of potato chips with a bold declaration splashed across the front, 0 grams of trans fat. I was glad to know that I wouldn't be consuming trans fat, which research has shown is detrimental to my health. But then I flipped the bag over and read the ingredients list, which included things like yellow number 6 and other artificial colors, and partially hydrogenated oil, which is trans fat, just a small enough amount that they can legally call it 0 grams. I thought it was incredibly ironic that these chips were being advertised in a way that makes me think they are not harmful, yet were really full of empty calories, weird chemicals, and ironically trans fat. It struck me," Francis writes, "that many Christians flash around their no trans fat label, trying to convince everyone that they are healthy and good, yet they have no substantive and helpful elements to their faith. Obviously, it's not what you advertise that counts. It's what you are really made of." I thought about that when thinking about Job, not only Job 27, I thought about that in particular, but the entire book of Job. You could make the case that the entire book of Job is on the question of whether or not Job is hiding trans fats. He's advertising that he's innocent. He's advertising that what's inside the bag is the same thing that's on the outside, but his friends refuse to believe him. His friends are making the claim, and at this point you should definitely put friends in quotation marks. With friends like these, you know, who needs enemies? But his friends are consistently making the claim, "No, we know you're claiming that you're free of these things, but you simply must have them in your life." And Job is consistently saying, "No, I'm innocent." And we know from Job chapter 1 that he is innocent. The problem of the book of Job is not whether or not Job is righteous. He is righteous. The Bible tells us very clearly. The problem is, how do we understand a righteous man suffering when the theory of retributive justice, which is the theory to which his friends ascribe, the theory of retributive justice says that the wicked are punished and the godly are blessed. We've talked about that countless times as we've worked through Job. That's the natural theory that we all are born holding to. And we all feel that. You can call that karma or whatever else people use, kind of a New Age or Eastern religion terminology. The idea that there's a kind of inherent, implicit balance in the universe. If you do good things happen. If you do bad things happen. And you can always find examples of where that seems to be true. Good, saintly people who are blessed when all is said and done, and bad people who are finally found out and tragedy befalls them. But the problem of the book of Job is the question of the exception to the rule. And frankly, there are a lot of exceptions to the rules. What about the saintly person who goes and helps someone in a wheelchair across the street, and they get hit by a bus in the process? That seems to be what happens in life more than not. It seems like the righteous pay a price and the wicked get away with it. And Job has said that already, more than once. Job has said, no, the theory of retributive justice can be refuted from two perspectives. First of all, the wicked seem to get away with it. In fact, if you look at history, lots of very wicked men live to be 90 years old and die peacefully surrounded by their subjects. On the other hand, lots of really good, godly people have everything wrong happen to them and end up paying the price. So the problem of the book of Job is this, that the theory of retributive justice cannot make sense of the world, because if you can show one man who is righteous yet suffers, you disprove the theory. Now, what Job is going to do in chapter 27 is twofold. Very clear division in verses 1 through 7 and then 8 through the end of the chapter. In verses 1 through 7, Job is once again going, and he kind of even digs in his heels further here. He's going to say, no, I'm sorry, I am innocent here. I refuse to say that this is because of some secret evil. I know that I am innocent in my life. And then the second part, Job holds out that in fact, the wicked will eventually reach kind of a judgment, right? They will eventually pay for their crimes. Now, it can be read in two ways. In one way, you can read it as Job saying only specifically to his friends, I am innocent, and if you say I'm not, you're evil. And he kind of says that to his friends. This is what I think of people who stand against me, Job is saying, or people who say that I'm lying, or people who say that I'm a hypocrite, or people who say that I'm smuggling in trans fats when on the outside of the bag, I said there are none. And then he gives this description. But if you step back and look at it more generally, what Job seems to be saying here, even though earlier he said the wicked tend to get away with it, now he's going to say, in point of fact, the wicked will eventually get judgment. And by the way, they will. It may just not be on this side of heaven, right? Eventually, we will all stand before our judge. So consider the first point. Job cannot deny his innocence. Now, if you look at verse 1 of Job 27, it says, and Job again took up his discourse. That's interesting because that's a formula, that little and Job again. That normally is what introduces a new speech from Job after one of his friends has spoken. But the problem is, none of his friends have spoken before this because in 26, it's Job speaking. So do you get the interesting conundrum here? Job speaks in 26, and then in 27, it says, and Job again took up his discourse, which leads commentators to believe, and I agree with them completely, that for the first time in the book, this rhythm of Job speaking and his friends were speaking and Job speaking and his friends speaking, for the first time that's disrupted. And between chapters 26 and 27, Job stops speaking, waiting for their response. They finally, for once, do not keep talking. He takes a breath and starts again. So this is why you have kind of the introduction to a new speech without a speech in the middle from his friends. It's almost like Job is probably caught off guard between the last verse of 26 and verse 1 of 27 because to his utter amazement, his friends are now silent. So he says, okay, I'll keep going. Watch what he says. Job again took up his discourse and said, as God lives, who has taken away my right, and the Almighty who has made my soul bitter. Stop right there. One of the things that Job is trying to work out, he's correct that the theory of retributive justice is incorrect, but he is incorrect in exactly what he thinks is going on. And as we've repeated numerous times, please remember that Job never read Job chapter 1. He's living this out. Job doesn't know about the meeting between Satan and God. He does now. I mean, you got to ask yourself, what is it like for Job now to read Job in heaven? Right? He's got to think, you know, if I could have just had a little bit of information about what was happening, I wouldn't have perhaps gone so crazy. Although perhaps he would have. As God lives, so he says, God has made him bitter, who has taken away my right, and the Almighty who has made my soul bitter. As long as my breath is in me and the Spirit of God is in my nostrils. Stop right there. If you look at verse 2 and the end of verse 3, verse 2, God has made my soul bitter. Verse 3, the Spirit of God is in my nostrils. That right there is the kind of spiritual schizophrenia that deep agony of the soul can bring about. On the one hand, Job has a quarrel with God, but on the other hand, it's a lover's quarrel. It is a quarrel from a man who loves his God. That's why I would maintain that Job never ultimately abandons his faith. Again, he gets close, but he never does. I mean, how do you say on the one hand, God has made my soul bitter, but the breath of God is still in my nostrils. I will speak no falsehood. He's wrestling with this, but he has not walked away from God. As long as my breath is in me and the Spirit of God is in my nostrils, which is an image from Genesis 2, of course, my lips will not speak falsehood and my tongue will not utter deceit. Verse 5, to his friends he says, far be it from me to say that you are right. Till I die, I will not put away my integrity from me. I am innocent. Now, whenever you see like a national politician say that, it almost certainly means they're lying. I mean, how many, think about your life. This is a bipartisan statement, I believe. I think this goes across all party lines. Anytime a national politician looks in the camera and says, I didn't do it, don't you instinctively think, you did it? I mean, Shakespeare's whole thing, methinks thou dost protest too much. There's a way to admit you're guilty, even by the way you say you're innocent. But Job actually is innocent. I mean, Job is just doubling down here and saying, you know what? I'm not going to let you badger me into a confession of something I didn't do. Sorry. I'm not going to cave. Till I die, I will not put away my integrity from me. I hold fast my righteousness and will not let it go. My heart does not reproach me for any of my days. Sorry, I'm in the right. Job was right. He was a righteous man, the book of Job tells us. His calamity was not a result of some secret wickedness. Verse 7, let my enemy be as the wicked, and let him who rises up against me be as the unrighteous. Which is an interesting turn of phrase, because who has risen up against him? His buddies. What is the primary gist of his buddies' accusation? It is that they are righteous and he is not. What does Job say in verse 7? In point of fact, I am righteous and you are not. If you want to assign guilt, Bildad, you're probably going to bust hell wide open. But I didn't do it. That's a paraphrase. That's the Message version. But he's saying, hey, you guys are sadly mistaken. Job holds fast to his integrity. Not having read Job 1 or 2, this puts Job in a dilemma. He knows, as we're about to see, that judgment will eventually catch up with the wicked. And he knows that something that looks like judgment has fallen on him. But he also knows that he's not wicked. So this is the dilemma of Job. In Job's mind, he's thinking, okay, I know that the kinds of things that are happening to me happen to evil men eventually. And I know that I'm not evil. So Job is caught in this kind of inner conflict of trying to understand what's happening. But the second point is this. Job cannot deny that judgment and calamity rightly and eventually befall the wicked. Verses 8 through 23 is a pretty chilling statement about what will eventually happen to the wicked. Now, keep in mind that he has just linked what he's about to say to his friends. Job's had enough. Maybe the reason they don't speak between chapters 26 and 27 is because of the look on his face. Mrs. Richardson, who is sitting over here to my left, claims erroneously that I have this look and tone I develop when I'm angry. I have no idea what she's talking about. I feel that I am just always sweet and gentle, like a small puppy. And I have no idea. She says, I'm telling you, man, this tone, I don't even know what she's talking about. Maybe Job has a tone. You know what I'm talking about? I know my mom did. You know that tone? You just start backing out of the room. Start backing out of the room. It's like, eh. They knew not to speak, and Job gives full vent to his frustration. What is the hope of the godless, verse 8, when God cuts him off? no hope. When God takes away his life. Okay, Job, just a few chapters back, says the wicked look like they get away with it. Remember this? And it looks like they get away with it. They grow old, they die in peace, their slaves suffer to the end of their day. But here, by linking judgment to death, Job is tacitly recognizing that eventually judgment will catch up with us. Eventually, even the wicked will have to pay a price. I don't remember exactly who. I think it was Robert Louis Stevenson who said, sooner or later, everyone sits down to a banquet of consequences. And that's true. Remember the beautiful moment a couple weeks ago when I read that Johnny Cash song to y'all? Sooner or later, God's going to cut you down. He got that from Job. I don't know that. Maybe. So, will God hear his cry when distress comes upon him? The his there is the wicked. It's a rhetorical question. The question is no. When judgment falls, it's going to fall, is what he's saying. Will he take delight in the Almighty? Will he call upon God at all times? No, not the wicked. The wicked will not. I will teach you concerning the hand of God. What is with the Almighty I will not conceal. If you go back through the last 27 chapters, 26 chapters, and some of you right now are thinking, please don't. Do you remember how many times they've accused each other of being fools and idiots? Like, Job, you don't know what you're talking about. And Job's like, you don't know what you're talking about. And they're like, Job, we will teach you. Do we not say the words of the wise? All the wisdom of the world is with us. Here, there's a kind of emphatic renunciation or a denouncement of that kind of thing. Job finally says, enough. I'm going to tell you the truth. I know the truth. You don't know the truth. All you have is your theory. And I'm telling you, your theory is mistaken. By the way, of everyone in the book of Job, every human being outside of the Lord, who was the one person who was in a position to know whether or not the theory of retributive justice was true? Job. Job knew if he was innocent. Job knew he was innocent. He knew they were mistaken. And that comes out here. I will not conceal. Verse 12. Behold, all of you have seen it yourselves. Why then have you become altogether vain? This is the portion of a wicked man with God, and the heritage that oppressors receive from the Almighty. That's kind of an amazing statement. That the wicked receive a heritage. It's a heritage of judgment. If his children are multiplied, it is for the sword, and his descendants have not enough bread. Those who survive him, the pestilence buries, and his widows do not weep. Now, I don't know. I've always thought that someone should write a book, an anthology of the great insults of the Bible. I would read that. There are some phenomenal insults. A lot of them would come from Job in the Bible. To suggest to your friends that they are so evil that when they die, their wives will not cry at their funerals, that's pretty stout. I like that. I'm going to keep that in my back pocket. What would you use that? That's the worst thing ever. Like, may your wife not cry at your funeral. That's the hardest thing I've ever heard in my life. But that's what Job says. Those who survive him, the pestilence buries, and the widows do not weep. Though he heap up silver like dust and pile up clothing like clay, he may pile it up, but the righteous will wear it, and the innocent will divide the silver. That is an amazing, what's called an eschatological statement. It is a statement about the future coming of justice for the poor who have suffered under the hand of the rich and the wicked. He is not saying that the rich are wicked, but he's saying that the wicked rich will heap up nice clothes, and eventually the poor are going to wear them. And they will heap up silver, but the poor will spend it. This is a radical change from what Job has been saying, by the way. I think he is shifting here because now he's not describing the world in general. He has seen the evil of what his friends are doing, and he is trying to warn them. Let me just remind you that God will one day deal with you. I mean, that statement, they heap up silver like dust and pile up clothing like clay, very reminiscent of Haggai. You remember in Haggai, when the exiles return, they build nice houses and put up wood paneling in their houses, but the temple of the Lord lays destitute. Remember this? And Haggai, the prophet, says, you have put money into a purse with a hole in it. So it's a picture of like putting money in your pocket and it just goes. By the way, any of you ever feel that way? Like the money you get it immediately falls into some abyss, never to be seen again. That's what Job is saying. Though he heap up silver like dust and pile up clothing like clay, which, by the way, are the mediums of creation in Genesis 2, dust and clay. You can't take it with you. Someone, it could have been someone in this church, I don't remember, someone last week sent me a text, and Hannah was sitting by me and said, what does that mean? It was a text of a funny thing they had seen online of a hearse pulling a U-Haul. And it said, well, I guess someone figured out how to take it with them after all. You know, and I told her, you know, the old saying, there are no U-Hauls behind hearses. But you know what? There still aren't. You cannot take it with you. It is like dust and clay. He builds his house like a moth's, like a booth that a watchman makes. He goes to bed rich, but will do so no more. He opens his eyes, and his wealth is gone. That may be a picture of death, that you shut your eyes and open it and realize that everything you built your life on is now gone. Very reminiscent of Jesus' parable about the man who built his house on the sand, right? Did not last. When the storm came, it did not last. It fell. Terrors overtake him like a flood. In the night, a whirlwind carries him off. One of the interesting things about great, great wealth and power is that those who have it are oftentimes very miserable creatures because they're so terrified of losing it. I read an article a few years ago about how a number of some of the wealthiest people in Hollywood are now having tracking chips implanted under their skin so that if they are kidnapped, the authorities will be able to track the microchip that's been implanted in their bodies and find out where they are. Now, I'm going to tell you something. I will never have a reason to do that. I mean, you imagine? But if you had so much that you were so afraid, what is your life like if you're having microchips implanted into your skin for fear of kidnapping? That comes with people who accumulate so much that they can't sleep anymore. They've got to guard it. Terrors overtake him like a flood. In the night, a whirlwind carries him off. I had a dear friend, Ronnie and I had a dear friend who was extremely wealthy, one of the wealthier guys I've ever known. And he was a good guy, but I noticed over time two things. He was obsessed about money and always said he didn't have any. He had it. And secondly, he was obsessed with dying and something happening to him. He told me once he had seen a news story about someone who had broken into a home somewhere in the city in which he lived. And he said, you know, I'll never forget this guy in a nicer house than I will ever live in, with more money than I will ever see, with nicer cars than I have ever seen. And I'm not talking about anyone in this church, not even in this state. Said to me, as a grown man, said to me, I lie awake at night terrified that someone's going to kick in my door. And I remember just something about that, thinking, maybe we don't want what we think we want. Maybe what comes with having so much is a complete lack of peace of mind. I've never gone to bed worrying about someone kicking in the door. I do if the dog starts barking uncontrollably and I immediately pull the covers over my head and have Ronnie go check it out. But in general, I don't. And I hope you don't. I'm not saying I'm terribly brave. I think about death. I'm not just really looking forward to dying. But I tell you what, I don't know that I've ever lost sleep over it. It's coming. It's coming. And when it comes, be ready, because you know the Lord. Terrors overtake the wicked man like a flood, verse 20. In the night, a whirlwind carries him off. The east wind lifts him up, and he is gone. That is a picture of chaff. Jesus used the image of chaff. In the old days, they would take wheat, you know, and they would, wheat and tares, they would open up both doors on the barn, kind of creating a wind tunnel, you know, the wind would pass through it, and they would throw the wheat way up in the air, and the chaff was lighter than the wheat, so the wind would blow the chaff away. That's what he's saying. It's a picture of chaff. The east wind lifts him up, and he is gone. It sweeps him out of his place. It hurls at him without pity. He flees from its power in headlong flight. It, this is the last verse. What is the it there? The east wind. Check this out. The east wind claps its hands at him and hisses at him from its place. Eventually, judgment will come. You know, time and time again in Job, you wish someone could have stood up and said, let me tell you about Jesus. Now Job knows Jesus. But it really is the missing piece from the puzzle of Job. That if Job had known that God himself would step among us and take judgment upon himself for us and suffer with us and for us, Job could have had a better perspective. It's not that all of a sudden when you trust Christ, you don't suffer. I remember Joe Cook telling me a couple of times, you know, people say I'm so brave, but man, I've had my moments in the court, of course. Who wouldn't? So would I. So would you. I mean, you'd have your moments in the midst of suffering of why is this happening and this kind of thing. But I tell you what, Joe Cook knew that Jesus Christ was with him and for him, as do all who are in Christ. And that makes a huge, huge difference. To be in Christ is not to never ask why. To be in Christ is to ask our questions of why in the shadow of the cross that comforts us. Before Christ who hung there, taking judgment in our place, suffering in our stead, and saying to us, I love you, and I'm with you. That's why the gospel is so beautiful. We don't have to sit alone on the ash heap of life and try to make sense of it all. We don't have to spiral into insanity because we can't reconcile the reality of a good God and the reality of suffering. We can know that there are things that transcend our understanding, yet God is still a good God who loves us. And he's still with us. And he has not abandoned us. And he had never abandoned Job either. Job knows that now. And I just pray that all of us know that as well. That through Christ, God is with us and for us and will not abandon us. Would you pray with me?